It's a different thing when you say we enjoyed this journey together. And I would actually say it sounds concise, it sounds understandable, but I have only really been there 3 times in my life, and I've had many, many dozens of projects.
My name is Paul Harvey, and this is Life, Passion, and Business. We're about helping you explore, finding your passion for life and the work that you do. But it's so much more than that. It's about finding clues to the big life questions. What does it mean to be successful? What is the meaning of life? If you're looking for more, then join me on this journey, where together we will discover through interviews, tools, and tips how to live life full of meaning, passion, and purpose. When Axel Meyerhofer was growing up in Germany, his uncle worked for Lufthansa. So whenever a plane passed overhead, his mother would say, "Look, Axel, there's Uncle Gert." A simple comment to a young child. However, it sparked his interest in aviation. His interest in flying continued throughout his young life, and he got accepted into flight training with Lufthansa. But they could not promise a job afterwards. So looking for job security and an opportunity to fly, he joined the German Air Force. He trained hard and became a pilot for the GR4, otherwise known as the Tornado. As we spoke on Zoom, I can say there was a twinkle in his eye when he mentioned that aircraft. We get lots of exciting stats about that plane, how it can travel at something like twice the speed of sound for about 20 minutes, while using enough fuel to power a house for nearly 2 years. We hear about his passion for technology and problem solving. The real opportunity for Axel came with a US Air Force exchange program, where he moved his family out to New Mexico and effectively joined the US Air Force. It was in this project that he learned the skills of team development and project management. Now, flying fast jets is a young man's game. The G-forces take its toll on the body, and in your 40s it becomes a challenge to continue flying. There was the option to fly a desk, but that was not that attractive. So he chose to leave the military and start a consultancy business while making the move to the US permanent. He found his goal-oriented training was much in demand. He was able to take his military skills and precision into the pharmaceutical industry. That work has led to some fantastic projects that have changed people's lives, people suffering from hemophilia and some rare childhood diseases. He says he likes the concept of the conductor. You don't have to be the best player of all the instruments, you just need to know how they fit together. His consultancy business is doing well, and not being one to stand still, Axel has turned his attention toward his passive income. With his talent for organisation, he has developed a system for property investment, and his portfolio is currently worth $1.5 million and still growing. Our conversation is about precision planning and preparation. It's about teamwork and leadership. Plus, we get to hear about his property investment process, a system that anyone can replicate. I hope you enjoy the conversation with Axel Meyerhofer. I'm delighted today, as I am always delighted to be with the guests, because I just love talking to people, to be with Axel Meyerhofer. Now, I know he was in the German Air Force and is in America and all, done all sorts of bits and pieces like flying and all sorts of exciting stuff. I also know he's into property. So I guess we'll discover all about this. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Glad to be here.
So look, this is Life, Passion and Business. And I can see, well, I can see you. My audience can't, if they've seen the picture, they know you're a gentleman of a certain age. You have been, you've had a journey. What has that journey been like? Where did it all start for you?
Yeah, it's almost a little bit, I would say, like two lives in one lifetime. The first life is basically going to school in Germany, being fascinated because I have an uncle who used to be an executive at Lufthansa. Mm-hmm. Even when I was little, every time there was a contract going by, my mom was pointing up and saying, "Look, Axel, Uncle Gerd is up there in the plane," as if he was in every plane, right, that ever flew. So But for me, that triggered the fascination with flying, and I wanted to become an aviator. And I wanted to join Lufthansa, but in the early 80s, when I got out of school, the economy wasn't doing so awesome. And so because of that, I had to look for alternatives, and one of the alternatives was to join the Air Force. So I joined the German Air Force, went through flight training, and then was one of the very first people who benefited from this tri-national approach between the
Brits. Let's go back in time a little bit, the early 80s, because I've always thought Germany was always doing well. Was that when the war came down around that sort of time?
No, it was basically the war came down in the early 90s. The economic thing was not so much that Germany as an economy as a whole did so bad, but the aviation industry didn't do so well. And so instead of continuously bringing in new people, and you have to keep in mind, and this is something that I didn't know at the time, I've learned later, that airlines basically are even today suffering from what they call a generational problem. And that is that really, if you think about civil aviation after World War II, it was pretty much all happening almost on a global scale all at once. And so airlines bought all kinds of planes, people were excited to fly, prices came down. And so a whole generation of pilots, and a lot of them coming up previously out of the air forces of the different countries, became pilots in these airlines in their, let's say, 30s.
Yeah.
And if you take that anywhere between 1945 and 1955, when I came along in the 80s, the airlines were pretty much full of people that weren't yet retirement age, and the airlines weren't growing as much anymore. So the need to bring in new people was not as high, at least so they perceived. Nowadays, they have the issue that a lot of people are about getting to retire all at once. And now the airlines have to think, I mean, Corona probably helped a little, but now they have to think, how do we replenish this large number of retiring people pretty much all simultaneously, because it's kind of generation after generation of aviators. But for me, it happened to be that they were pretty much full. The industry wasn't growing as much anymore. So when I said I would like to join, they said, we can take you through training, but we can't guarantee you that you're going to have a job. And as somebody who just came out of school, that wasn't really a very amazing kind of perspective to have. And my family had raised me to say, you want to try to find something secure, right?
So you went into the German Air Force, that sounds a bit. And what did you find?
Not secure as far as the job, but secure as the income comes, right? So I joined the German Air Force and was one of the very first people, like I said, who benefited from this tri-national approach of building a fighter jet between Britain, Germany, and Italy. So I was one of the very first people trained to fly the Tornado, or GR1 as you guys call it. And I was trained actually in Cottesmore. So that was my first foray into the Queen's English and living in Britain for 9 months and learning how to fly the plane.
If my audience listen hard enough at a certain time of day, no, they probably won't happen today, but often you hear them flying over here.
Yeah, exactly. And I had the benefit of really seeing the beautiful landscape that you are in, Paul. And then ultimately got to my first base and got to fly around, and then showed some interest in how do these planes actually work, got into test flying. And what I had to learn is that these little black boxes that are in these planes oftentimes come from defense manufacturers, and a lot of them are actually in the United States. Mm-hmm. So my wife and I came over to the US 3 or 4 times a year to these defense contractors, because as a test team member, that's the place you go to learn how do these things actually work. You bring them back home, integrate them in the plane, and then you start writing the checklist procedures, all that kind of stuff.
This is sounding all very technical. Let's go back to the flying bit again. So what was the passion about flying? Because, obviously, being a fighter pilot, effectively, that must have been quite a thing to do.
Well, I think the first part of passion was just the amazing technology.
Yeah.
And
how fast do these things fly?
Well, when we came by, like when you hear it coming by, it's about 10 miles a minute.
Okay, that's pretty quick.
Or they call it 600 knots.
10 miles a second, I think you mean, don't you?
No, a minute.
A minute, okay. Yeah, 10 miles a minute. Okay, that's pretty quick. Yeah, 600 knots.
Just imagine something 10 miles away from where you are and think you could be there in 60 seconds.
Yeah, it's quite fast, isn't it?
It is pretty fast, yeah.
Is that the top speed they fly at?
No, the top speed, like, at least with the Tornado, is close to Mach 2.
Okay.
Which is about 2,000 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's with the afterburners going full racket and burning and burning fuel at an incredible rate.
Yeah, tanks are empty in no time. Yeah, like a Tornado without external tanks going full speed, all you can eat, as we call it, takes about 20 minutes to go in.
Yeah, okay, you made make sure you...
Just to put this in some perspective to your audience, that amount of fuel that goes through is enough for a house to be heated for 2 years.
Yeah, that's a bit shocking, isn't it?
And we were able to get through that in 20 minutes.
So. Yeah. It is amazing when people don't realize quite what is required to do these things. It's like, you know.
Yeah, on the other hand, I mean, it's also, if you think, and it's very hard to imagine if you've never done it, if you accelerate something to even 1,000 miles an hour, and you imagine this thing is 40 tons fully loaded.
Yeah.
That's like a big lorry full of goods going 1,000 miles an hour. That's just, you know, so you can imagine that takes a lot of energy to get there.
It takes a lot of stopping as well, I'd imagine.
Well, see, the thing with the stopping is that you have three dimensions. It's not like on a road. You can go up, that stops through. You know, that it gives a big break.
Yeah, but you're gonna hit some G's if you do that, though, aren't you? That's gonna hurt.
Yeah, that's why you retire at 40, because you can't handle it anymore, you know.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Well, your body can't take that level of turn and level of stuff, can it?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So, okay, you're in this job. It sounds like it's an exciting job. Let's be honest. It is exciting to be in that role, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, there's so many different things. It's not just the flying itself. It's also the purpose of the flying.
Yeah.
Right. Like when I first started, it was still common that people were learning how to drop bombs. Then it became smart bombs, like laser guided and stuff like that. The technology is fascinating, but that was interesting. Then we started to convert into rockets, right? Like nowadays, the whole what is modern warfare, without going into the details, is the people in the planes don't see each other, and they typically don't see their target either. It's so far, the distance between adversaries is very far, and the technology gets more and more advanced, right? And that was what fascinated me, is to keep pushing the envelope of what is possible technology-wise to actually accomplish the goal, right? The flying thing is very, very cool, like we just established.
Mm.
But when you go to the purpose of why do I take a plane into a conflict, like, for example, in Bosnia, right? Like, we needed to find a way to get the Serbs to no longer harass any other planes that wanted to help in the conflict. So we used the missiles to take out their radars.
Yeah,
they never saw us. We saw their electronic footprint. We took out their radars. That's a very, very sophisticated, and I don't want to go into the technology, but it's a very sophisticated approach and capability you need to develop. And then the air crews need amazing amount of training to go through all the steps to make sure, because you don't want to have collateral damage. You need to be absolutely 99.9% sure that you actually hit the thing you want to hit.
Yeah.
And so those kind of things, that was my fascination, to go back to your original question of getting into it. Now, I didn't know all the things that I would be fascinated when I first joined. I was just fascinated in the flying, but more and more of the things emerged. And that also meant I became more and more fascinated by all these kind of cutting edge technologies, which brought me then to the United States, learning how these boxes are made and what they can do. And my wife at some point said, you know, it would be nice if we wouldn't just go here for 3 or 4 weeks for a training course, but could stay a little longer. And I found out that there was an exchange program between the German Air Force and the US Air Force, where you literally take another person's job.
Mm-hmm.
I came to the US Air Force, literally all, you know, get my US Air Force uniform, literally became a US Air Force member. I would have gone to war with the US Air Force had there been one.
And was that strange? I mean, there you are, a man with a German accent in a full US uniform. You must open your mouth and people go, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, I mean, they made sure in the program that you were at least a captain or higher in rank, right? To have a little bit of a position powers.
You would need it, I guess, because you would get crapped on by someone, wouldn't you, otherwise?
Yeah, that's true. That's definitely true. I mean, I became the assistant director of operations, so people were pretty friendly because they wanted to fly, and the ADO decides who flies and who doesn't.
Okay.
But fundamentally, I have to tell you, one of the things that is, you know, we hear stuff in the media, we read articles, we documentaries and so forth, but it really ever really goes down to the work level. This potentially perceived strangeness, yes, it is there to some extent, but it almost like with a snip of a finger goes away as soon as you say, why are we here and what's our mission?
Mm, yeah.
But then we were like really a band of brothers. It doesn't matter.
You're focused. You have a job and you're trained to do that job and you all drop into training, I guess. That's what happens.
Right. And it's also, you know, you acknowledge and appreciate people's contribution and capabilities much more than all this other stuff, how they sound, how they look, where they come from and so forth. That's really in the bigger picture, not that important. Mm. And I always appreciated that. The other thing is, I mean, this is not just because it's cool for a German guy to go to the US and vice versa. It's also because it's very different approaches. And without going into too much detail, most Europeans, the British, the Italians, the Germans, everybody in Europe, because of the limited resources, we are all basically bound to always work goal-oriented. Right? We say, okay, here's a goal, here's something we want to accomplish. How can we get there with the least amount of resources? Because that's our starting position. We always have not enough resources, but we still have ambitious goals.
Yeah.
In the US, because they have resources and amazing, everybody who ever pays attention, what they put in their defense budget is just insane. It's more than the next 10 countries combined in the world every year for the last 25 years.
Yeah.
So the amount of resources, and it's not just money, it's people, it's equipment, it's all of that stuff, but their system fundamentally allows them to say, it's what we would call command and control. So every step has a description of how to take it, what is the pre-step, what's the next step, and so forth. And the funny thing is, I don't want to go into too much detail, but when I joined this US fighter wing as an ADO, they had just a year before come back from Desert Storm, from Iraq War.
Mm.
Right? And so I was highly interested to say, so how was that, especially in comparison to what I was used to with this goal orientation? And they said, yeah, we had trained with these binders and binders and binders of bookshelves of all these rules. And when we got in theater, we basically threw them away because they don't work. Right. So that was a really interesting trigger for them to say, we want to have somebody, we're interested in learning from somebody who comes from this goal-oriented situation, because our training didn't really prepare us well for when we actually went to war and needed to be goal-oriented. Right. And so that was really enjoyable. And yes, I sounded weird, but I had something to contribute, you know, so that made it pretty, pretty enjoyable. And ultimately, after the first foray in flying with the US Air Force, the German government made a contract to build a training center in the United States, which added another 5 years to my original assignment. And by then I reached that point where the G's didn't really like me anymore so much. And the question was, retire yes or no, which became yes. And then retire where? Europe or the United States? And I had offers from companies here in the US immediately to help me with green card and work permit and all of that.
Perfect.
So that's why that transition went pretty well. And here we are still 26 years later.
Do you still fly?
No. Well, I used to fly with airlines or be flown, but not myself anymore.
You don't fly yourself anymore. Oh, well, there you go. It's a...
Yeah, there's a little bit of a saying, I haven't used it because not very many people have asked me recently, but I used to say, if you had the pleasure of being a Formula One driver, why would you want to fly a bus or drive a bus?
I guess that is true, actually. Yes, I guess it must be tough. Yes, I agree. Yeah, of course it is. Yeah.
Well, I mean, as an aviator in the military, I always said, you know, when we had to fly somewhere with an airline, we called them takeoff and landing officers instead of pilots.
Yeah. I can understand that. Yeah. I mean, I have a real difficulty with this stuff because I love the technology. I get so geeked out by the technology, and yet I hate what it does. I have a real problem with what it's designed for. It's like, if only we could put this kind of level of resource into being good human beings and creating a better planet. But we put this all about around
I know we have. I know there's a reason for doing it. I just hate the fact that it has to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, on the one hand, if you purely look at it from a conflict perspective, I would say it's hard for me to see that people anytime soon will be able to overcome conflicts in a peaceful way. The other thing that is, for anybody interested in the technology, I would say these days, the difference that used to exist when I joined the military between what military planes and inherent technology could do versus airliners, that difference is almost gone away. And the frontier that is basically replicating that difference that used to exist in flying planes of different kinds now exists between flying planes of any kind versus space. If you look at this, and maybe this builds a bridge for you to say, okay, what we learned in aviation and a lot of the systems are now being used by companies like SpaceX and Boeing and so forth to make human beings interplanetary and allowing ourselves to have at least an alternative if we screw up what we're doing here on this planet, maybe building something that allows us a second go around, so to speak. You know?
Yeah, well, hopefully we don't need it. We can make this one better, but there we are. So obviously you stayed and you worked for different companies in the States, because that's...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I stayed. I started working as an executive for a software company first. I also on the side went to school and got a PhD in leadership and organizational change, because wow, everybody told me I needed supposedly a lot of academic credentials. And I'm not saying it's wrong, but it was probably a little overdone. So, but ultimately, I decided in 2005 that I wanted to build my own business and go out on my own. And so I did that, still do that. And that also triggered partially why Natalie, when she first contacted you, pointed to my forays into investing. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to find out, okay, if I go out on my own, coming from this military background, how can I somehow create passive income for a point in time when this quote unquote second life comes to an end and no longer having to worry or depend on any kind of government systems to give me enough money to sustain the family?
Right.
That's how that actually started. And I've done that all along, and ultimately to a point where people said, hey, what you're doing there is actually pretty interesting and obviously works. You have the proof, right? It's not just me pitching something that I've never done myself. I've literally lived through it and doing it every day. And so people ask me, can you help me? And so that's what I do to some extent, besides the consulting these days, is other people help.
What is the consultancy business? What is that?
Well, mean? The consultancy is basically helping, strangely enough, you will shake your head and say, this guy is weird, pharmaceutical companies to complete their projects. So for example, creating a new product or scaling a small scale product to a large scale manufacturing or stuff like that. Yeah. All these things that have a time frame or time bound, right? If you say, okay, I want to do something new, I've not done it before, and here's the end point, here's that, by the way, the goal orientation is repeating itself.
Well, that's what I was gonna say. You've taken your military training and you have applied it to the business world.
Yeah, and I didn't go literally out and say, let's go into the pharmaceutical industry. They brought me in for some strategy thing one time. I thought that would be a one-time thing, and then I go back to where I'm comfortable with the military stuff. And they kept asking me back and back and back, and the military stuff faded more and more into the distance. And nowadays it's pretty much all pharmaceutical.
So is there a passion in that for you? Is there a drive in that for you?
Yeah, there is a passion. I mean, it has evolved a little bit. The drive was always, is there really a way for certain illnesses to find a cure? And I'm really, really happy to say that I've been involved in a couple of projects where we really, in the honest, true meaning of the word, have and are in the process of developing cure, not just treatment. And I find that super exciting, right? If you think about somebody, like one project I did for Bayer about hemophilia, right? Like you have a genetic error that doesn't allow your blood to clot. And there is now a technology called CRISPR, not going to go into the details.
I know what CRISPR is, yes.
We are so sophisticated now that we can take that missing piece, integrate it into your gene, reintroduce it into your body, and let your body replace it so that after a while of that treatment, you make the blood clotting factor yourself. right? So no more treatment where you have to inject yourself with factor eight all the time. You're getting that particular gene
Yes,
therapy.
because fact, because I remember, because the hemophiliacs, they were the ones that they were the first people to suffer from the AIDS problem from blood, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
And from
yeah.
and hepatitis C and other bits and pieces, they got nasties. They got quite badly beaten by that, didn't they? So this is a great opportunity to.
Yeah, I actually my first project was 2013 in that particular field in the hemophilia field, and at that time, 2013, there were a handful of people older than 40. Most of the other ones had all died from HIV infections.
Yeah, well, of course,
And not because of their lifestyle, but just because of their injecting for hemophilia. So that's one example. There is a spinal dystrophy, for example, in children. There's a project here that I was involved with in our area in San Diego, another gene therapy where you're injecting repair genes into the spinal cavity and teach the body how to actually make the correct genes. And these poor kids, if they don't get that treatment, the muscles and the nerves don't connect and they basically can't move.
Mm.
Right? Their spine is there, but it can't really do its function.
It doesn't have the code. Yeah, doesn't have the right code.
And I've literally been there where babies were born. And they were, as sad as that sounds, like a lump of meat. And then I've seen them running around as 5-year-olds, completely normal. That is what I mean by cure, right? Versus some treatment, some pill or some injection that you give somebody. So I that is really exciting to be part of that, even though I'm always saying I'm not the expert, I'm not the scientist, I didn't study pharmacology or anything like that, but being involved in organizing it so that we can continue to make leaps forward, then that's exciting to me.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? I mean, it's like, yeah, it takes coordination of effort, as you say, and that's what you discovered early on in your military career. And applying it into services like this is amazing.
Yeah, exactly. I like this concept of the role of a conductor.
Mm.
Right. As a conductor, I personally believe you don't need to be the best player of any of the instruments.
You just need to know what order they go in.
Well, you need to know how they're all going, how they fit together, and how you want to interpret what somebody put on paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And making those people that are sitting in your orchestra all do the best job they can when the performance is up for the audience. That's, and I enjoy that role, right?
Mm. Yeah, it's good. It's good. Well, good. Yeah. So, I mean, the next two questions in a way, you've kind of sort of asked them, but I'm going to say them anyway. So how did you, I mean, success for you has obviously changed over the years, but it sounds to me that it's very similar. Because it's about organization.
Well, organization is one thing. When stuff works, I'm really happy. I would say success is one level beyond that. And yeah. I would say success for me is when it works because the people really gel into a coherent team that enjoys collaborating with each other.
Ah.
That's a different quality. There's one thing to say, we just make stuff work by following procedures and following rules and submitting our stuff to the authorities and so forth and so forth. It's a different thing when you say, we enjoyed this journey together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And I would actually say it sounds concise, it sounds understandable, but I have only really been there 3 times in my life and I've had many, many dozens of projects. And you get close every once in a while, but for example, the first time, and that's why I knew and now still know how that feels, was this flight training center in New Mexico, the collaboration between the US Air Force and German Air Force making this flight training center work. We were an amazing team. And I mean, what we accomplished in those 5 years is still blowing my mind. And many other people said, I don't know how you guys did that.
Mm.
And there's many, many layers of little details and little pieces of evidence that show that. But the human or humanistic component of really coming together, almost like finishing each other's sentences, anticipating what the next person needs, when is it needed? What do I need to do? Not because I feel like it or because somebody told me, but because I'm doing it in support of the overall team and the goal that we're trying to accomplish. That's a very special chemistry, a very special, it's like one
But
of
that's
those.
exactly what you just said. That's the conductor, isn't it? That's
Exactly.
the orchestra plays that. It's the intuitive process. Because it's like a jazz band. They all work together in the chaos, but produce unity in something. And it's
And part of that form of success has a lot to do with trust.
yeah.
Right, because it's you if you're still in the phase where you're challenging or going through this norming, storming, performing kind of stuff and so forth, there is a level that is not addressed in this whole concept that goes to a level of trust and understanding and collaboration that goes way beyond what these methods basically describe. And jazz is really a great example for that because you trust everyone in your band to express. But also know when the time for self-expression should be replaced by somebody else's or the whole band's self-expression, right? And so that is a level of trust that is not that easy to establish, especially because people have different personalities, different aims, different goals, different perspectives, and so forth. And it starts out with saying, can we really commit for the whole journey? Right. And one thing that's true with this forming, norming, performing type of stuff is when you lose an important player, whether it's in your jazz band or in a team like that, you oftentimes get set back quite a ways because somebody else, it's not really that they are bringing in friction, but it takes a long time to reach that level of gelling together
The
and
well-oiled, yes, the
harmony.
well-oiled machine on it,
Yeah,
absolutely.
exactly.
So, I mean, that's a great description of success. That's a really good description of success. What about contribution? I mean, clearly, the medical stuff you've contributed to, but how do you see yourself as contributing?
Well, one of the things that I looked at in the context of this, how can I ensure the passive income for myself, was going back really to the beginning of this whole Maslow hierarchy of needs aspect. And when you go to that, it's basically food, shelter, and safety are the three fundamental, most common starting points if you look at that hierarchy. And
For sure.
so for me, by the way, it didn't have like stock investments or venture capital or anything like that, right? Just side note, because some people try to convince me otherwise. So I looked at that and said, well, I can't really do food. I did safety. That was my first life. So what in my second life I can do is shelter, right? And so one of the contributions is that I'm basically providing shelter for families in the form of single family houses of good quality at a fair lease rate. And I'm helping them in that sense by having shelter. I'm helping the property management company. I'm helping my family through the passive income it generates.
So is that so that's a another business that you operate, or is that what
Well,
is
it's not
that?
really a business. It's basically what I did for my consulting company as basically my retirement plan. And yes, I made a website called Ideal Wealth Grower, and I put a bunch of videos out just because it's one of the things where more and more people said, hey, can you explain how you do it, right? Because and I read somewhere that you move deliberately to where you live right now, right? And so what's happening in the United States a lot, and I would say, I think in our pre-interview we spoke about the London area or other metropolitan areas in Europe or in Britain. It's more and more tricky to really find anything that allows you to expand or have sufficient space in these big areas. And the same is true here in the United States. On the other hand, when you say, well, so how can I actually generate passive income? There are places in the country where that balance between how much does it cost me to buy something and how much can I bring in rent is still in a good balance. And so the strategy that I developed for myself first, and then people said, well, I'm interested, how do you do this? Is to live in San Diego and invest out of state, like you live in London and you invest in somewhere in Scotland, because there you can buy a property and get a reasonable level of rent, which is still affordable for the person who moves into your place.
Okay, so
Right.
you personally have a company, or you do it from a personal perspective? You buy properties.
Well, I have my company that I always had, but I'm buying the properties in my name I own the properties personally because it's also then my passive income, basically.
Okay.
And if I ever stop working in my consulting business, then it will still be my passive income.
Because there's a thing in this country, and I've seen it before, someone operates it, where you basically set up a group of people come together as an investment group. And you put and you pull and you pull resources so that you can then buy properties as a group.
Right. We have that too. Here we call that syndication.
Yeah, it's a syndicate process. And so they buy a property and then the property is then renovated and then a buy-to-let mortgage is put onto the property so they get their resources back and they go into another one. And obviously the property is then paid for effectively by the people that rent it. So and the group takes an income over time.
Right. Yeah. The tricky part is unless you already have a pretty well established reputation and background and so forth in syndication, at least the way it is organized here in the US is that the different people who built the syndicate have to basically put their contribution in what I call 100%, right? So what that means is you have a property, let's say a 20 unit apartment complex. The syndicate wants to buy it. It costs $1 million, and you have 10 partners, and everybody puts up $100,000.
Yeah.
And then you buy it for $1 million. The problem, or it's not a problem, but the difference why I'm not necessarily suggesting that is because it doesn't really allow for leverage, at least not in the beginning. If you look in comparison to the deals that I do or help other people to do, same way like I do for myself, is you find a property, you buy it yourself, and you finance it with 80% financing. So that's a 5-to-1 leverage, right? But legally here, from a funding perspective, you cannot say, I make a syndicate and let the bank take 80% of the risk.
Okay.
Right. So in a single, it's the same, basically not very different than if I were to buy a property for my own residence, I can put 5, 10, 15, 20% down and the rest is from the bank. I can do this for an investment property too. But as soon as I'm saying there is Paul and Axel and 8 other people and they all want to buy this place, the bank says, well, good luck with that. Right?
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah, it's a fascinating conversation. And obviously it's worked for you. It's worked out for you. And obviously you've got this. Is it a book you've written for it?
No, I haven't written a book about it. I've written something I call the Mindset Manual, which is also on the Idea Wealth Grower website, because I found that a lot of people who are interested, maybe even to the point of fascinated about the concept, run into all kinds of issues. They either think they need to be rich, or they think that they don't know the right people or don't have the right connections, and on and on and on. I call that basically the state of mind of victimhood. You cannot do something that you actually want because you feel as a victim of all kinds of external circumstances.
Right, right, of course.
And the other group of people, which I'm trying to encourage people to transition to, and that's why I wrote that ebook manual, is basically to say, I want to be in the creative mindset. I'm in where I am right now. I establish a BHAG, which stands for Big, Hairy, Audacious Goal.
Yep.
And now it's a matter of how do I take the journey from where I am to this big, hairy, audacious goal, and who can help me to get there?
Yeah.
And then I create my own future. And I use the term time freedom point because this big, hairy, audacious goal is basically to say, okay, what is the number of passive income money that needs to come in every month so I no longer have to exchange time for money or have a job for that matter?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you say, okay, this needs to be, let's say, $3,000 or pounds for that matter. Then I can look at, okay, how much money do I get out of one property? And let's just say £300 a month, just for the sake of argument.
Yeah.
Right. So then I know if I want 3,000 as my time freedom point, then I need 10 properties. At least it looks like that at the beginning.
Yeah.
The reality, if we were to go in the details, you probably only really need 7 or 8, but fundamentally that's the way. So now, you know, where I am, I have none. I need 10. That's my time freedom point. How quickly can I get there? And you might say initially 7, 8, 9 years. And as you get going, you become more and more a creator of your own future. And most people get there faster than they thought.
Right.
And as soon as you can see that this passive income starts coming in, it's very amazing how the whole mindset of people change, myself included. Because we, at least in the United States, through the media and everything else, we're being basically conditioned to always chase after the next opportunity that makes money.
Ah,
And
yes, the
right?
shiny object syndrome.
Yeah, in a way. But then as you get closer and closer and you see maybe not the full amount, but let's say you get 1500 pounds a month, and next year you bought another property and now it's 1800, and then you buy another property and you increase the rent on the previous ones and now it's 2200. Now somebody comes along and says, "Hey Paul," or, "Hey Axel, I have this issue. Can you help me? How much would it cost?" And you know the person can't afford it, right? In the previous mindset, you would probably say, "You know what? There are all kinds of places you can go because I need to chase after the pound or the dollar." Now I can say, "You know what? I'm happy to help you, even if it doesn't make me money, because guess what? I have these six, seven, eight properties that make me money, plus what I'm doing anyway. I can be more generous." And you get more and more and more generous with what you learn the closer you get to your time freedom point.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating story. Okay, so what links do people need to look at to get to this information?
And the website is called idealwealthgrower.com.
Okay, so that link will be on the
And then
show.
it immediately pops up and says, "Do you want the mindset menu? Do you want the newsletter?" You know the whole game, right?
Okay, all right. So you're gonna push people for an email address then, obviously. So if you want to get in touch with, explore this with Axel and his information, check out the links above, or check out the just say the when I say the link again, because I didn't catch it all. It's
It's idealwealthgrower.com.
Idealwealthgrower.com. All one line.
All
Okay,
one
well
thing.
I'm sh okay. Well, that link will be on the website Life, Passion, and Business, and on the show notes above. Are there any other social media links people can find you on?
Well, if you put Idea Wealth Grower, then we have Instagram, we have YouTube. One thing maybe that I would love your audience to ask to take a look at is the Idea Wealth Grower YouTube channel. Because one of the things I found is that some of the hesitation to even consider real estate for retirement or passive income and stuff like that is that there is, like in many other industry, a ton of jargon. And so I took it upon myself twice a week to do a short, like 5-minute video, just kind of explaining stuff, you know, like what's an appraisal, and what's an ADU, and what's an underwriter, and so forth. And not just to say, "Here's the definition that you can find on Google," but more like if you put yourself in the mindset of a creator who wants to develop passive income, how do all these terms apply to you if you really take this approach and you really take it serious? And understand, because anybody who is within their slice of the industry, they all rattle down this jargon as if everybody knows. And you can quickly get into the place of where you feel lost. Same thing with the mindset menu, right? You can download the manual, but I did a 7-part series in videos that explains each part and how it applies and what to think about and what to maybe do first, second, third, just to help people along. Because I oftentimes, and this is kind of a little bit our whole discussion, I take myself as a measuring stick in most things, right? If nowadays I'm saying, "Okay, I don't know how this works or that works, what do I do?" Well, I used to go on Google, now I go on YouTube, right? So I thought, well, people could read and still can read if they go on Google, but if somebody makes a video where they actually tell you and show you, that's probably more enjoyable, right?
That's
And
what I'm
so,
looking for. I think if it's something practical, then I go to Google. If it's something intellectual, I actually go. If it's something practical, I go to YouTube. If it's intellectual, I go to Google.
Exactly. And I'm the same way. And I mean, there's so many things where, you know, even like you get a gadget, they don't even come with a user's manual anymore. So what
No,
do you do, right? You
no,
go on
no.
YouTube and let somebody explain it
No,
to
indeed, indeed,
you.
indeed. Okay, so I mean, oh, if that's the main your main thrust at the moment, do you want anyone to connect with you about your other work and your consultancy stuff, or is that just not necessary these
No,
days?
I mean, then is, so I unless you have a pharmaceutical industry executive who needs my help, then feel free to contact me. But when you're more likely somebody who wants to get to this time freedom point, wants to see what you can do to generate passive income the way I do it, you know. And I'm, by the way, I'm glad to say I finally figured out a way that it also works for non-US citizens or green card holders. So I have a financing source now. If anybody says, "Hey, these little houses in the Midwest that pay $1,000 on a $100,000 investment per month," then I can do this now. Not me
Fantastic.
personally. Yeah, I have the relationships. I'm not doing it myself,
Well,
but.
okay. Well, if you want to work, catch up with Axel, I think is all I can say on this one. Catch up with Axel.
Well, I'm just bringing it up, Paul, because you said, you know, when we first spoke and I described the deers, you said it would be hard to find something like that in Britain, right? But it's available here. So if somebody said, well, if I can't find it in Britain or in the EU, I find it in the US. It used to be very hard to do, but now it's possible.
Well, that's interesting. That is interesting. So, you know, we have two questions left. So one question is, what's the one question I haven't asked you that I should have done? But you've been pretty...
The one question that you didn't ask me is what I do when I don't work.
Oh, that's a good question. What do you do when you don't work? Because you don't fly anymore.
I'm not flying anymore. What I do when I don't work is gardening.
Ah, perfect.
I really like to grow stuff. And especially with the pandemic, we tried a few things, you know, our own veggies and some raspberries and stuff. And not everything worked, but a bunch of things worked. And we really felt a substantial difference versus the supermarket stuff. So this year I have 3 raised beds. So I'm
fantastic. I have a few of those too. Last year I started a bit more seriously growing stuff last year, and I had salad right the way through until the end of November. I was still taking salad out the garden. So.
Yeah. I'm still debating, do they taste better because we grew them ourselves, or do they really taste better?
I think it's a bit of both, actually. I think there's that smugness that you grew it yourself, isn't there, really?
I mean, I always say to my friends, the effort that you put in contributes to the taste.
I think there is something. I mean, like, you get fresh peas from the garden or fresh pea sprouts, and you can't buy pea sprouts anyway because they just wilt. You go and grow some pea sprouts, and anyone can grow pea sprouts. You can grow them any time of year, anywhere, and they grow to about 4 inches. Whip them off and put them in a salad, and it's like eating peas. It's just amazing. So they're really easy to grow, and they're really quick.
I totally agree with that. But what I was getting at is, you know, you might find somebody on the farmer's market who grew them and gives you literally the little pot, and I would still claim my own taste a little better.
Yeah. Well, I think that's because of the speed of harvest. If you take something out of the garden and stick it on your plate, it's always going to taste better.
Totally. Yeah.
And look, I'm going to geek out on this. I need to be careful because I can get into my subject. All right. So the big question, the final question we ask all of our guests, what is the meaning of life for you?
The meaning for me is helping others help themselves become successful.
Sounds pretty succinct and pretty good.
Well, that's been my motto all along. It's and as I mentioned earlier, the further I get or the closer I get to my time freedom point, the easier it gets to focus on that helping part and not so much how much does it make for me.
Yeah, wonderful. So Axel Mahofer, thank you so much today. It's been a lovely to talk to you. All the best.
Awesome. Yeah, Paul, I really enjoyed it. I like your style and the way we got the conversation. So thank you so much for having me.
All the best.
That was Life, Passion and Business with Paul Harvey and my guest, Axel Mayerhofer. If you'd like to find out more about the retail investment process, check out the website idealwealthgrower.com. You can also find Axel on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and on YouTube. As always, you can find the links for that at lifepassionandbusiness.com. Just a quick reminder, did you catch the shortcast every weekend? Every Sunday, we put out a shortcast, a 10-minute program, which is a reflection on what I've discovered throughout that week. This week's program is all about the limits we set on ourselves and how we can push through them and move beyond our expectations. So do check it out. You can find that at the website under Shortcasts. And while you're there, do check out the Resources tab. There is the 5 Questions worksheet and other resources for you, plus Focus Coaching. And that's it for this week. Thank you so much for being here and supporting this program. If you like this podcast, if you like any podcast, please support your content creators with likes, shares, and better still, reviews, because it's the reviews that help the platform determine what is a good podcast, and they help people like yourself find good podcasts. So that's it for now. Thank you so much for your time and attention, and I'll catch you later. All the best.